Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
At the beginning of the Second World War, thousands of houses across the country were requisitioned by the government to provide accommodation for the armed forces, secret services, government officers, as well as vulnerable children, the sick and the elderly, all of whom needed to be housed safely beyond the reach of Hitler's Luftwaffe. It's the subject of a fascinating new book called Our Uninvited Guests by Julie Summers. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK. Julie Summers herself. Julie, good morning to you.
Good morning. It's a lovely sunny day here in Oxford.
It's a lovely sunny day here. I can just see the Mediterranean. If I stand on my chair, I can just see the Mediterranean as well. So there you go. But oh, to be in Oxford when the weather is so lovely.
Great treat.
Now then, the weather may have been lovely in Oxford in 1939, 1940, but if you were a country house owner looking across your stately lawns, maybe put in by Capability Brown, thinking, you know what I'm going to do today, and suddenly the phone rang or a telephone rang or a telegram arrived saying, you've got 2 hours and you're going to be housing hundreds of East End expectant mothers.
I mean, it must have been the most extraordinary feeling. And I think some of the landed gentry felt very aggrieved. Lord Selborne had just done up his beautiful house in Hampshire, and he learned that a girls' school was going to be taking over the house. And he was absolutely furious. But in the end, he decided that having a girls' school was probably better than having the army.
Well, indeed.
He had a good reputation.
So tell me a little bit about, joking aside, tell me a little bit about how this all came to pass. Because obviously Britain had a lot of stately homes. I mean, we all think Brighthead visited. But, I mean, there really were quite a few landed gentry in the 20s, 30s and 40s.
There were indeed. And what's really interesting is that life had changed after the First World War. And a lot of the people who lived in these vast houses really couldn't afford to do so anymore. And the Second World War came at a turning point where lots of houses became properties of the National Trust. And many were pulled down after the war. But let's go back to 1939. The government knew that it was going to require an awful lot of property, because unlike the First World War, which was fought on the continent of Europe, this war would be total war because of the reach of the Royal Air Force and the Luftwaffe. And they knew that they would have to protect the vulnerable, the sick, and children and civilians who would otherwise be trapped in London, Glasgow, Liverpool and the big cities. So they set up a register in 1938 to record every house in Britain that had more than 4 rooms downstairs. That's an awful lot of properties. And indeed, many of those houses were taken over, but they were used for very small government departments or offices that were moved out of London and back very quickly. But the bigger houses, houses like Blenheim Palace here in Oxfordshire, or large houses, Bletchley Park famously was taken over for code breaking, they were taken over for a variety of reasons. So Blenheim was occupied initially by 450 schoolboys and 100 masters from Malvern College, because Malvern College had been turfed out of their buildings by the Admiralty. So there was a sort of knock-on effect. And then we had a story of Brockett Hall in Hertfordshire, which was the home of Lord Brockett. Lord Brockett had rather unpleasant sympathies. He was a renowned Nazi sympathiser, and he actually attended Hitler's 50th birthday party. And his hall was taken over, and it was requisitioned by the Red Cross and handed over to the London City Maternity Hospital.
There's a wonderful sense of karma in that one, isn't it, really?
I think there is. And it is a remarkable story. So the babies were born either in the Lord Melbourne suite or in the Ribbentrop bedroom.
And isn't it true? Because, I mean, a lot of these families came from the East End of London, especially sort of the maternity and the children. I mean, they had never seen houses like this. And when they walked in, there's a beautiful story in the book about women thinking that they must have died during childbirth and gone to heaven.
Yes, indeed. I mean, can you imagine, you know, giving birth in such opulent surroundings when you lived in a tenement or a tiny flat in the East End of London? And it was very striking. So many of the women who spoke about their experiences at Brockett Hall remembered the vast gardens, the beautiful decor. So the Prince Regent suite, which you just referred to, was the room where the mothers went to recover after they'd had a cesarean section or had some kind of anaesthetic. And many of them did wake up and think they died and gone to heaven because they were surrounded by peacocks on the wallpaper and a gold pagoda bed. I mean, it was a really grand bedroom which Lady Melbourne had designed for her lover, the Prince Regent, in the late 18th century. And just, you know, one of the things one has to remember, these houses were built to be looked after by an army of servants for one or two very spoilt inhabitants. And suddenly, in the war, they were taken over by hundreds of people who had no army of servants. And so Audley End in Essex was offered as a hospital to the government, but the government turned it down because it had room for 200 beds, but it only had one lavatory.
Good grief.
It's little details like that really appeal to me, because you suddenly realise there's this extraordinary juxtaposition, because we think of big houses being enormously luxurious, and they sure were luxurious if you had that army of servants to lay fires, to clean up after you. But if you didn't, they were just huge, cold barracks.
How did these houses actually operate? I mean, presumably with something like Malvern Boys' School, because it's a school and the masters are there, and there's a fantastic picture that I've seen of them all sort of dossing down, very regimented in their beds in the grand hall, as it were. But so for a school to operate, I can imagine they already had their rules and regulations to get by. But for a bunch of East Enders rocking up at your stately house, how on earth did they instill discipline and make sure that nobody ran off with the china and the whole thing sort of functioned?
Well, things were packed away, so the owners were given time to pack all their precious belongings away. So, for example, at Brockett, where the maternity hospital operated, all the grand furniture and the famous paintings had been put into storage. So what the maternity hospital got was a suite of magnificent rooms devoid of furniture, so they brought their hospital furniture in. And in fact, you know, a maternity hospital runs under extremely strict rules, so that wasn't a problem. And in the main, big properties were taken over by an organisation. I think the trouble came in the war when evacuees were sort of let loose in smaller numbers at people's homes. Then there was trouble. But in the main, the big properties were fairly well run, because they were taken over by an organisation of some sort.
And there's a story about one woman who refused to let the refugee or the evacuees come in, and so she was locked in her kitchen.
Yes, that's a fabulous story. It happened after Dunkirk, and suddenly there was an enormous influx of men from France, and they had to be housed somehow. And so the Ministry of War simply announced there'd be another wave of requisitioning. And this one lady in Kent was not happy that her grounds and house were going to be taken over. And so she put up a protest, and the army simply locked her in her kitchen and moved in. So, you know, there was almost no right to recourse. There was almost no way somebody could say no.
We mentioned before about the East End mothers who were giving birth in stately homes and how wonderful it was for them. But it wasn't like that for all expectant mothers. Those who had illegitimate children were treated quite differently.
I know. I found that very shocking, actually. When I was doing the research for Brockett Hall, I came across the story of a mother who had gone to Brockett Hall in about the fifth month of her pregnancy because she was having an affair with a married man, and she was married as well, so it was a really disgraceful situation in those days. And her husband-to-be, because he did eventually marry her, dropped off at Brockett Hall, and she was taken straight down into the cellars where the kitchens and the washrooms and the baby bathing place all happened. And she was taken down there. She was given a brown dress to put on, and she was called a brownie because that's what they were. They were the brown jobs. They were the disgraced women. And they worked in the kitchens and in the washrooms and so forth for the whole of the rest of their pregnancy. And they slept in attic rooms at the top of the hall, accessed by a spiral staircase, a back staircase, so that they wouldn't be seen by the pure married mothers. And they only went into the hall itself, into the grand rooms, when they were in the second stage of labour, and they were put into a print dress rather than the brown dress, and they were taken upstairs, delivered of their child, and then the child was taken away from them, put straight down in the nursery, and they were only allowed to feed the child every 4 hours, and after a week it was taken away. And there was something so brutal about it, something so regimented and angry at these poor women, many of whom would have got pregnant by accident, because birth control really wasn't widely available. And, you know, women were taken advantage of considerably. And I just felt really heartbroken for them, actually. And a lot of unmarried women came to Brockett Hall, you know, in the hundreds. And I think probably about knocking on 10% of the babies born at Brockett Hall were illegitimate.
You talk as well about the fact that frequently when you had the army staying with you, it was more trouble than it was worth. And those of us of a certain generation will remember Brideshead Revisited and the opening scenes for that, where Jeremy Irons, you know, is billeted somewhere overnight and then wakes up in the morning and realizes he's back at Brideshead.
Yeah.
And it's all terribly, terribly reminiscing nicely. But the army tended to be the worst, some of the worst guests.
Well, they certainly were the worst guests. They had the worst reputation. And unfortunately, amongst the armies who were living in Britain, it was the Canadians who burnt more houses down than anybody else. And I think you have to remember that these were young men who were going to go out and fight. They were being trained to kill. And very often they were homesick. They had little prospect of coming back safely. And I think they just found themselves enraged by living in the grounds of, the men lived in the grounds of these stately homes, and the officers lived in the house itself, so already there was a sort of aggravation going on there. But also the fact that these young men really had no help in the house. So they had these, as I mentioned before, these cold barracks, and they didn't have any heating, they often didn't have hot water. You know, they were not comfortable in the sense of we feel when we read about Brideshead or, you know, Highclere Castle that became Downton Abbey, that there was simply the question in the army's mind as to how best to house their men and officers while they prepare them to go to war. And so the houses were simply a convenience, and that's why they weren't treated with respect. And there are stories of American soldiers deliberately driving jeeps into gateposts and, you know, riding bikes up and down staircases and so forth, because they were bored to some extent. You know, it's very easy to judge, but it's also quite important to remember that they weren't there because they wanted to be there.
Well, Melford Hall, which you mentioned in the book, I mean, when the owners came back after the troops moved out, they find their wine cellars seemed to be intact, and when they went to the wine...
One of the regiments, there were 12 regiments at Melford Hall over the period of the war, and one of the regiments drank all Sir William Hyde Parker's magnificent wine cellar and then refilled the bottles with water and recorked them, which, you know, you wonder why they bothered. Just drink the whole... It's extraordinary, some attention to detail. But very sadly, Melford Hall was burned down. There was a fire that was started when some young officers at a party went into the forbidden North Wing, which is where all the family's treasures were stored, and they set fire to... They set a fire in a hearth, but there was no grate, and so the fire burned through and got into one of the ancient beams. The house is Tudor, and it smouldered away overnight, and at 5 o'clock in the morning it caught fire, and the local gardener, one of the gardeners from the hall, saw it and went and rattled Sir William Hyde Parker's door and said, you know, your house is on fire. But it was in February 1942. It was a desperately cold winter. The pond was frozen, so the fire engines couldn't get water, and yada yada yada. It was a really sad story, and the whole of the North Wing was destroyed and most of the West Wing was destroyed. But amazingly, after the war, Sir William and Lady Hyde Parker rebuilt Melford Hall from scratch. And when you visit it today, you really can see no damage at all from the fire. It's extraordinary.
And also the fact was that what they didn't know, but what the commanding army officer did know, was that there was something rather special about the North Wing and the West Wing.
Yes. So what was really frightening, when Lady Hyde Parker ran to the hall to ask the officers to help her evacuate all the precious treasures in the North Wing, they could still get into one part of it, and there were Stubbs paintings and Titians and goodness knows what, and the commanding officer refused, and Lady Hyde Parker was shocked, so she ran to the Nissen huts and she roused the men, and the men helped her. And the reason the commanding officer refused is because he had got an enormous illegal munitions dump in the cellars of the North Wing. So can you imagine what would have happened if that had blown up? Fortunately, it didn't, but it would have been absolutely horrendous.
It wasn't just, as I said, refugees, evacuees. There were some SEO trainees as well, especially up in the Highlands of Scotland, which is where, you know, they were running around the Highlands training.
Yes. In 1940, when almost all of Europe was occupied by the Nazis, the British realised they would have to do something to help the nascent resistance movements, particularly those in Poland and Czechoslovakia, but also France was beginning to rumble and the resistance grew in France and Belgium and Holland and so forth. And what the British did was to train young recruits, men and women, equal. They didn't believe women were any worse than men, or they were as good as men in terms of becoming radio operators and saboteurs and so forth. But these young people needed to be trained. And so what the Admiralty did was to cordon off a whole area in northwest Scotland from Fort William up to the fishing village of Malleg, which is a distance of, you know, several dozens of miles, and all the properties in that area that were large enough were taken over, and they were used to house the recruits while they were trained in the fine arts of silent killing, sabotage, explosives and so forth. And they would be trained up there for 3 or 4 weeks. It's a beautiful but very harsh environment, and absolutely ideal for training people to live off the land, to move across the land unobserved and so forth, all very, very useful tactics. And those young recruits were then sent to holding houses in the rest of England and lower parts of Scotland. So Audley End, which I mentioned, had Polish agents, and there were other houses around the place in Essex and the southwest. And these young men and women were held, and when the time was right, they were then parachuted in or flown into France, Belgium, Czechoslovakia, and so forth, to meet up with the resistance movements or to carry out attack. So the most famous attack of all was carried out by the Czechs in 1942 when two young men murdered the acting Reich's protector Reinhard Heydrich in Prague, and they had been trained up in northern Scotland. So it was really interesting. And I think, again, that was the sort of area I hadn't really sort of got my head around before.
And also, there's something quite poignant about Audley End, which I didn't realise, and reading through the notes of your book, was the fact that the stunningly high number of Polish SOE operatives who were lost, 316 parachuted in, 108 lost. Which is a horrendous figure, but also those who were captured by the Gestapo and then under interrogation had those who survived, so they had a special part for Audley End, had a special part for them. Just explain a little bit about that.
The Audley End had a special part for the
those who were captured when they were being interrogated.
Oh yes, they did. Well, because it was very important that when the young men and women were flown into occupied Europe, that if they were caught, they didn't give anything away. And so they had a practice room at Audley End where a young recruit would suddenly be, you know, hauled out of bed in the middle of the night, thrown into this room, and he'd be given the Gestapo interrogation. And he had to remember, or she had to remember immediately, their code name, all the facts that they'd been taught about Poland, which were updated from when they were in Poland in 1939, 1940. And so they had to really recreate as best as possible the drama that they would face if they were caught by the Gestapo.
I mean, one Polish veteran said that when they were in prison or Gestapo torture chambers, their thoughts went back to Audley End House. Pleasant memories gave them the strength and the will to survive. That's why Audley End House is such a dear place to us.
I know, it's remarkable, isn't it? And there was another story about a French woman, courier who was caught by the Germans in France, and he was tortured, and he remembered the Dalmatian dog in the house that he'd been staying in as a safe house before he was flown into France. And while he was being tortured, he tried to remember where the spots were on the Dalmatian. It's really poignant. I think we think about the war at this distance, and there's a bit of glamour, a bit of drama, but it was very, very unpleasant. And these special agents, I have so much respect for them, because they knew they were on a mission that would almost probably end up in certain death. And I think that's incredible that they were so courageous.
Another thing that shocked me was the number. You just said earlier there were 12 regiments moving across, you know, were in one house during the war. The amount of people moving around the British Isles during this period, was it 38 million moving, and there was a population of 39 million in the UK?
That's just the UK population. So the UK population was about 39 million, and the Post Office, the General Post Office, recorded 38 million changes of address. So that was just the UK population. But on top of that, you had over 20,000 Polish soldiers, sailors and airmen. You had 5,000 Czechs. And eventually you had 1.3 million American GIs, of whom 130,000 were from Alabama and black regiments. There were Canadians. And in addition to that, there were many people who had sought exile in Britain. So there were French and Polish and Danish and Norwegian. I mean, it was an extraordinary. London was a complete melting pot in the 1940s, and I think we sometimes forget that in Britain. We think that, you know, little old Britain stood on the edge of Europe, defiant against the great Nazi threat, and it did. But it had a huge amount of help from our friends and neighbours across the water. As I say, we had King Haakon from Norway, who gave us his 1,300 strong merchant fleet plus its sailors, so that helped sail across the Atlantic. We had Queen Wilhelmina of the Netherlands, who came again with some soldiers and sailors. The Danish royal family put up £8 billion in gold, which is really helpful. So there was a lot of help, and all these people, of course, had to be accommodated.
So in the stately homes of England and Scotland, you would find the European royalty sort of knocking about, kicking their heels as well.
Oh yes, absolutely. You did not know when you knocked on somebody's door who you were going to see. And Queen Wilhelmina had a cottage in the countryside. Charles de Gaulle had a house in Buckinghamshire. President Benesch from Czechoslovakia, he had three houses in Buckinghamshire, all very modest-sized. But he planned the assassination of Heydrich in a little manor house in Wingrave in Buckinghamshire. So extraordinary goings-on.
How did you research this? I mean, how did you come across... I mean, because it's an absolutely fascinating tale, and it's one that we think, oh, yeah, people were evacuated and houses were taken over, but people have never really looked at the impact socially, economically, on the local populations. I mean, how did you get all the... And the colour that's in the book, I mean, how did you research this?
Well, it all started out when I was up in Harrogate. I was doing some research for the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, and I was looking at how many burials there are in Britain of Commonwealth War Grave soldiers and sailors and airmen. And I went to see the Hotel Majestic because my father told me that his grandfather, my great-grandfather, had lived and died there in 1945. So I went to look at the hotel and said, yeah, I'd love to see where my great-grandfather lived. And he said, well, he wouldn't have lived here during the war because it was requisitioned. And I said, oh. In fact, he didn't live at the Hotel Majestic. He lived at the Prince of Wales, but that's a sort of side thing. And so this janitor, who was really knowledgeable, explained to me that the whole of Harrogate was going to be taken over. The hotels, the spa buildings were going to be taken over by the British government had the Nazis landed the Colossus, which is what people feared they would, by way of an air raid in 1939. And I thought, God, that's fascinating. And the post office occupied the George Ballroom in Harrogate and so forth. And I just got thinking, and I thought, ooh, I wonder whether there's a story here. And then I knew that Blenheim Palace had been occupied by MI5, but what I didn't know was it had had schoolboys for the first year. And so the whole thing just snowballed, and I began to ask questions, and people said to me, well, you must look at this house, or how about that house? And the houses I chose in the end were houses where there was contemporary material. So, for example, when I wrote about Aldenham Park, which was a house taken over by a Roman Catholic school, they had actually written a diary of their time at the house. So I had day-by-day accounts, hilarious in some cases, but also very sad in others, of people taking over this house at Aldenham. And so I concentrated on the human story because that ultimately is what interested me most. So I chose not to do Bletchley Park because it's a very well-known house, and actually the story about Bletchley Park is the Codebreakers. But what I wanted was the human story, so what it was like for Lady Hyde Parker to see Melford Hall going up in flames, how she coped, what it was like for Lady Acton to have not only this girls' school from Kensington, but also the greatest Roman Catholic scholar of the 20th century, living in Acton, in the Acton's house in Aldenham, translating both books of the Bible while being priest to the little girls. You know, that was what really got my attention, and I thought, gosh, there's a story there. And so I just carried on, and I had to go and visit all the houses, which was fabulous. But it was really brilliant to see, you know, all the different stories coming out, and there was just so much to tell, and I could have written a book that was three times as long, but I think it would have been used as a doorstop rather than something to read.
And there's a wonderful thing about a woman who was asked whether she preferred having children to the French resistance trained killers, and the reply, if you can remember it, is absolutely wonderful.
The reply is, I prefer the agents because they don't bite. Because the evacuee children had been very naughty. She'd had a particularly bad batch, poor woman, and I think they'd been a pretty troublesome lot, so she was much happier to have the French resistance fighters, even though, of course, her life was very dangerous. I think this is the other thing we don't really appreciate. She was brave enough to say that she would have these French agents who came from London stayed at her house for one night or two and then were flown into France by Lysander aircraft. She had to do this all in complete secrecy. And she couldn't tell anybody in the village what she was doing. She couldn't tell her mother. And she lived in fear that somebody would rumble what was going on in Bignor Manor. And if somebody had rumbled, it was quite possible that she would have got into very serious trouble and may well have, you know, given the game away with what these agents were doing there.
They don't bite, they don't wet their beds, and they're much more interesting.
Yes, exactly.
The book is called Our Uninvited Guests. It's out now on Simon & Schuster. Julie, if people want to find out more of this brilliant book, how can they find you?
There's a Facebook page, Our Uninvited Guests, or there's my website, which is www.juliesummers.co.uk, and it's in all good bookshops.
Julie Summers, author of Our Uninvited Guests, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much indeed, Giles. It was an absolute delight.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.